Well, thank you, Daphne, for that introduction. And perhaps once I start to talk about this teaching of Padmasambhavas, from that introduction, you might get a flavour of why it is so dear to me and so much a part of my practice. It is a passage, a teaching that I meditate on, and that I just go for refuge to when I need to do that. So I hope that you get a flavour of that when I'm giving my talk. And there's a lot of you here, so I hope that people will hear it too. And I've got to take my glasses off and on. It's that granny thing. So, so before I actually talk about the text, I was just thinking about what's been happening over the series of talks that you've been having. And you've been hearing, first of all, from the Hinayana tradition, the Pali suttas that give factual stories about the Buddha's life and his teachings. So you've heard from that tradition. And then you moved on and you heard from the Mahayana tradition. And the Mahayana tradition is very different, and it kind of it appeals more to the imagination, to the imaginative part. I will say it reaches the parts that other parts don't reach, but actually that's not quite true, because the Vajrayana, which is coming next, does that. And the Mahayana sutras kind of expand the teaching of the Buddha into wonderful realms, cosmic realms. And these teachings, they inspire us to practice, not just for ourselves, but for the benefit of all beings. So it's expanded out to bring in all sentient beings. And last week we were invited to a cosmic pantomime, part of the Mahayana tradition, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. Also a householder, but of course an enlightened householder, and I'm not one of these. We were treated to the cosmic pantomime, which invited us to kind of throw away all our misconceptions and open our mind to the teachings of the Buddha in quite a different way. So as the Hinayana tradition, it had a tendency, as you know, to become a bit narrow and a bit dry, a bit dogmatic. So the Mahayana tradition could also have a tendency to, you know, keep your head in the clouds. Kind of be a bit airy-fairy. Just a bit, but losing your groundedness, losing the groundedness in our own experience. So what developed next? What was the next jhana that developed? And what was needed? Well, it was a diamond thunderbolt. A diamond thunderbolt that cut through all our nonsense, cuts through all our illusions, cuts through our energies, brings the whole of us right into our own experience and into our practice. And that's the Vajrayana. And Vajrayana literally means the way of the diamond thunderbolt. Jhana is the way, Vajra, the diamond thunderbolt. So it's a wake-up call. The Vajrayana is a wake-up call. So the Vajrayana are teachings that engage our deepest energies, whatever these energies are. The Vajrayana challenges us not to leave any bit of us behind. You know, we can't forget about the bits that we don't like or the bits that we don't talk about and just bring what we think are the nice bits along into our practice. The Vajrayana challenges us and helps us by the teachings to bring all of us, all our energies along on the path. And the great teacher of the Vajrayana is Guru Rinpoche, the precious Guru, Padmasambhava. And here he is. I don't think I need to say much about that. I think it speaks for itself. This wonderful, wonderful image that to me just speaks of huge compassion for whatever is happening in my life, whatever I'm bringing along with me. Padmasambhava has that compassion to hold that for me. So this is Padmasambhava. The lotus-born guru. There's somebody here with a lovely lotus t-shirt that says the lotus flower. So very appropriate. So Padmasambhava, I think most of you will have heard of Padmasambhava, but I'll just say a wee bit about him. Not a lot. He was invited to Tibet by the king of Tibet at that time. And the king of Tibet had been very moved by the Dharma and had wanted the Dharma to spread in Tibet and had invited a practitioner, a very good, enlightened practitioner, the monk Shantarakshita, to come and to teach the Dharma in Tibet. And he did, and he came and he taught the Dharma, and he converted many of the people in Tibet to Buddhism. However, there were certain forces in Tibet that just weren't having any of it. And these were the Bongpo practitioners, the practitioners of what at that time was the sort of religious doctrine of the time, the Bon religion. And these practitioners, there were shamanic practitioners, and they were said sorcerers and magicians of the highest order, or so they thought. So Padmasambhava was invited to Tibet because the king thought, well, we'll get him along and see if he can do anything with the shamanic practitioners, the Bongpo. And it was about 800s Common Era, so that gives you kind of timing of when Padmasambhava was in Tibet. However, you can't really pin that down, because Padmasambhava, as well as being a real person, a person who was in Tibet, is also, you know, there's a great magic and mystery and myth around Padmasambhava. So while he was in Tibet, he was there for I don't know how many hundreds of years, converting the Bongpo to Buddhism. And he used all sorts of skillful means to do this. So he used rigorous debate, and he also used the highest magic that was even higher than the Bongpo's magic. And he was able to transform these demonic forces that were hostile towards the Dharma. So he subdued these demons, and he brought them along in the path, and he transformed their energies. And, well, you know that Tibet was a country where the practice of Buddhism was very widespread. So it's one of Padmasambhava's teachings that we're going to look at, and it comes, you perhaps saw me reading from this book. This is the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, and it's in two volumes, and it was written by Yeshe Trogyal, who is one of the women who asked for a teaching from Padmasambhava, and she was his main consort and disciple. And she wrote about the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, about his time in Tibet and his leaving. And when we're coming, when we're looking at this teaching that was given just about the time when Padmasambhava was going to leave Tibet, he'd done his work there, he'd subdued the demons, he'd taught all he could teach, and he was ready to leave to go to the land of the Rakshas. And this is a world of, we're told, flesh-eating asuras and ogres. And he was going there to teach them the Dharma. So these three women, these three disciples, wanted to have final teaching from Padmasambhava before he left. So that's where he was off to. He was away off to the land of the Rakshas. Okay. So I was going to get people to read out this. There's quite a lot of you here. But I think I will do that. But I don't know quite how to organise it. I don't know how it will work. So maybe there's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 8 chunks to read out. So I wondered if we start with you and maybe move round this way. Would that be okay? And you could read out some pieces. So if you could read the introduction down to Buddhahood. Thank you.
Then Ganchen, the glorious noble queen, invited the Guru, that second Buddha, into the temple of turquoise dedicated to her tutelary deities, piling up on precious throne fine silks and tables of divination, and regaling him with many pleasing things. She greeted him respectfully and made this request: "Give me a few words of great import, an effective verse which I can memorize. Though I have not renounced the world, I would like to cherish within me a doctrine which at a later time would lead me to Buddhahood."
Thank you. So here we have Queen Yangcheng, this glorious noble queen, and she's wanting a teaching from Padmasambhava, and she hasn't renounced the world. So she invites him into her temple, and she prepares this temple beautifully. We get a lovely description here, of piling up on a precious throne fine silks. So she's very, very respectfully preparing this space for this communication with Padmasambhava. She obviously has a great deal of respect for her guru, and she wants to show her devotion. It's a very devotional text, I think, as well. So she shows him by this that she's respectful and that she's open to his teaching. She's receptive to his teaching. She wants to sit there with him and have this communication. And she's also honest about her current situation. She's very honest that she hasn't renounced the world, that she's a queen. I mean, we can imagine the beautiful palaces she's got, perhaps. We can imagine her subjects. And she's very open and honest with Padmasambhava. She says, "I haven't renounced the world." But she is on her own spiritual journey. And I think that's quite clear from the way that she asks Padmasambhava for the teaching. And what is it she asks him for? Well, she asks him for a few words of great import, an effective verse. So she asks him for something really important, something that she can take with her, something that she can practice. That's what she asks him for. Something that she can follow and that she can use to help her progress along the path. And as was the tradition at this time, she asked for something that she could memorise, because it was a tradition this time that teachings were given and you memorised them, you learned them off by heart, so that you could bring them to mind when you needed them. I was actually reminded when I read that again of a story of a friend of mine, who was a child during the war. She was maybe about 9 or 10 during the war, the Second World War. And her mum taught her to learn by heart 2 or 3 really inspirational poems, because she was frightened that they would be captured and imprisoned. Because she thought that may well be what happened during this war. So she taught Jenny these inspirational poems so that if that happened and if she was in captivity, she could bring these inspirational poems to mind to keep her sane and positive in her capture. So I thought that was a really kind and inspirational thing to do for your child. In a time, you know, it must be really frightening in those times to bring up your children then. And I also think, too, from my own perspective, I haven't got this off by heart, but I've got, there's a passages of it off by heart that I've learned by heart, but somehow, you know, phrases from this teaching bubble up into my consciousness when I'm least expecting them, and I really have to listen to them. And normally they bubble up at very opportune times, appropriate times for me. So Queen Yang Chung wants that kind of teaching, a teaching she can learn from heart, that she can cherish, and that she can use to help her progress spiritually. So here she is, a glorious noble queen, and she's very respectfully, honestly and openly asking for a teaching. Right? And a teaching that will lead her to Buddhahood. Not a teaching that will make her a nicer person, not a teaching that will make her a better queen, but a teaching that at a later time will lead her all the way to Buddhahood. So she knows where she's going, she knows where she wants to be, and she wants a teaching that will help her to do that. And I also think that this shows great faith in her teacher, that she would ask Padmasambhava for something she could memorise, and she's confident that that will lead her all the way to Buddhahood. So could you read the next bit? Padmasambhava replies.
To this the Guru replied, "Listen, Queen Yang Chung. To begin with, pay urgent attention to impermanence. Then strongly turn your mind towards taking refuge and direct your prayers to the lamas. These are the preliminaries without which no means exists."
Thank you. So, no messing about. Listen, Queen. So listen well, okay? Pay urgent attention to impermanence. Don't waste time. This is why I have my friend with me here on the shrine. And he sits on my shrine along with other bones and feathers and carcasses, etc. Because although up here I know about impermanence, then here, no way. But Padmasambhava is saying, pay urgent attention to impermanence. You've really got to take this in. You haven't got time to waste. You're going to die. Pay urgent attention to impermanence. And I've been reading a transcript from a seminar that Sangharakshita did up, I think, a long number of years ago with a group of men. They studied this passage, and I liked some of the language that he used when he was talking about this part of the teaching. He talked about the precariousness of life, the precariousness of prosperity, the precariousness of a sense of happiness, of a sense of security. And none of that is real. None of that's real. That's what Padmasambhava is telling us. None of that's real. We can't rely on it. We can't set our faith in it. So when we take this on, this reality of impermanence on more and more deeply, well, what do we do? You know, what do we do? Do we fall into despair? You know, do we fall into fear? What do we do? Well, we know in Buddhism that we always have a choice. We always have choices that we can make. And there are two Pali terms that describe these choices that can be made when we're at, you know, when we're taking this on more deeply. And one of these terms is karma chandra. And chandra means desire or urge. So karma chandra is a desire or urge for sensuous experience of the senses. So it might be that as we realise more and more deeply the reality of impermanence, that we think, oof, what the hell? I'm going to the pub. I'm away at the pub. Or I'm going to eat chocolate. I'm going to watch the telly. It's just all too much. And go away and lead a hedonistic existence. And then the other term is dharma chandra. And again, we've got chandra. A desire or urge. And this time, the desire or urge is for spiritual experience, for the dharma, for the truths. And so we can take refuge or go for refuge. We can pay urgent attention to impermanence, and then we go for refuge to the three jewels, to the things that we can rest our faith on. And Padmasambhava is telling us that that's what we must do. We must pay urgent attention to impermanence, and we must strongly turn our mind towards taking refuge. Not have a little dabble here and a little dabble there, pay a wee bit of attention to it, but we must strongly turn our minds towards taking refuge. And again, if you think this requires us to bring all of ourselves into our spiritual lives, whatever that is, putting all our energies into it. And then he says, and direct your prayers to the lamas. And we might think, oh, prayers, lamas, what's that all about? Because we bring with us, well, I bring with me, a lot of Christian conditioning about praying and God and all the rest of it. And I have thought about this, you know, I have reflected on this quite a lot. Turn your prayers towards the lamas. So I thought, well, what is that about? And I think for me what that's about is about being receptive. It's about being open, receptive to spiritual guidance, being open and receptive to the teachings, to the Dharma, being open and receptive to teachers who are further along the path, know a little bit more. So to me that speaks of receptivity. And, well, what's wrong with praying, you know, in times of need? Perhaps it's helpful to pray. And, of course, that was a tradition in Tibet as well. We know from the prayer wheels that we see, prayer flags, that praying was very much part of the tradition, praying in terms of prayers for the benefit of all sentient beings. And then he says, these are the preliminaries without which no means exists. So what does he mean by that? These are the preliminaries. So without reflection on impermanence, don't waste time. Without going for refuge to the three jewels, and without being receptive to spiritual guidance, there's no means towards enlightenment. So prepare well. Could you read the next wee bit?
After that, disposing yourself physically to be calm, as in an empty house the raindrops slowly gather, relax. Do not force your mind or body. Since the tranquility of Shunyata is the foundation, by forcefully turning your mind to emptiness, you chase misconceptions. In the thoughts which arise, understanding will come without doing anything.
Thank you. So now that the preliminaries have been observed, Padmasambhava says, relax. That's what he says. Relax. Do not force your mind or body. And I don't know about you, But I'm so unused to that, you know, the idea of relaxing. So he's not saying when you're sitting on your cushions, force your mind to dwell on the breath. He's not saying, right, squeeze every last bit of metta out of your poor wee heart. He's not saying that. Relax. Relax. But yes, I think in our Western world, we're so conditioned we're quite driven, aren't we? We're quite driven as a society. So we're driven, we go for it, we're very goal-orientated, we want to succeed, we want to achieve, even if it is we want to achieve enlightenment. But Padmasambhava is saying, well, actually, that's not the right way to go about it. You know, you don't need to do that. You need to relax. And he gives a nice illustration as in an empty house, the raindrops slowly gather. I think, an empty house. You know, and I try to kind of visualise that picture of an empty house, maybe with a wee hole in the roof, but of course he'd be talking about Tibet, so there might be, I don't know, openings here or whatever. And it's like, it's raining. Now, it's raining. It's raining. The rain falls. Rain falls down. Raindrops fall. And the raindrops gather. They're not pushed down. They're not shoved down. They're not poured down. They just fall. They fall and they gather. So I think that helps me. I don't know if it helps you, but that kind of image helps me to think about the kind of tone of that relaxing that Padmasambhava's trying to get over to us. So how do we do this relaxing on our cushions? I have a busy life, as you heard, and it can be, you know, we all know how difficult it is when we get in our cushions. Some of us don't, but I find it difficult when I get in my cushions to relax. And I was remembering when not long after I had been taught to meditate, and the order member who was teaching me to meditate said, so now that you've learned the mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, when you come in here on a whatever night it was, and you sit in your cushions, what does it feel like? What does it feel like? And I thought, So I said, well, actually, what it feels like is I'm gathering all the bits of myself. And they're gathering, they're just coming together and kind of going. So I had that experience of, as many bits of me as I could. Well, there were loads of bits out there that I didn't even know about. But I had that experience of gathering together all my energies and becoming just a bit more integrated. And I think that's what Padmasambhava is getting at. That integration, that feeling of just being a bit more of ourselves, bringing a bit more of ourselves here. And when we do that, when we're aware of more of ourselves, when we're aware of how we're feeling, when we're aware of the thoughts that are going around our heads, when we're aware of what's happening, you know, the feelings around, maybe it's warm, maybe it's cold, when we're aware of what's going on internally, well, we do start to relax. Well, that's my experience, that I do start to relax. So I think this is what Padmasambhava is saying to us. Start to come together, bring your energies together, have a sense of integration. So then Padmasambhava, he goes on to say, since the tranquility of shunyata is the foundation, by forcefully turning your mind to emptiness, you chase misconceptions. And some of you will be very familiar with the term shunyata. And I know that Pasada is going to be giving a talk in the Heart Sutra next week, and perhaps we'll delve into our shunyata more deeply than I'm going to do. So here Padmasambhava is describing something much more refined. You know, I was talking about integration and you know, that sense of relaxation when I'm on the cushions. And Padmasambhava starts to talk about shunyata, about emptiness. And I think we have to be very careful how we think of this term, shunyata. Shunyata, emptiness, it's talked about as emptiness, it's talked about as no thingness, it's talked about as open, direct, open experience. It's described as like the clear blue sky. So it's a state of mind, that we would be in if our meditation was going in a particular way. But we have to be careful that we don't take it too literally to mean sort of nothingness, and it's a bit nihilistic and a bit depressing, the idea of shunyata. Is that, you know, how I understand shunyata as much as I can understand it, is that yes, it's voidness, it's emptiness, but it's also full, you know, it's full. What's it full of? To me, it's full of spiritual potential. That's what shunyata is full of. And I sometimes think of a beautiful loch. When you're thinking about the tranquility of shunyata, I think of a beautiful loch, sparkling in the sun, nothing interfering with the motion of the loch. But that loch, it's full. It's not empty. The loch's full. So yeah, that just kind of gives me a wee flavour of the tranquility of shunyata, a tranquil loch. So tranquil yet vibrant. And he tells us that the tranquility of shunyata, that tranquility, is the foundation. Foundation of what? What's the foundation for insight to arise? And if we try to pin it down, if we force our minds to try and understand shunyata, emptiness, if we try to grasp the ungraspable, well, we are deceiving ourselves. We're deceiving ourselves and we lose it all, not to mention give ourselves a big headache if you're doing that kind of thing. And what Padmasambhava says then is that in that tranquility, in the tranquility of shunyata, which is the foundation for insight to arise, understanding will come without doing anything. So we don't have to understand here. We don't have to dissect the idea of shunyata. We don't have to do any of that. But in that tranquility, in that spaciousness, in that vibrant potential space, understanding will arise without doing anything. That's what it does. Wow, that's great. So, Pidimai, could you read the next one? Mm-hmm.
In thoughts which arise, understanding will come without doing anything. Again and yet again, work on whatever estranges you from meditation. Lay bare whatsoever arises, good and bad thoughts alike. The child who knows his way carries along the path every harmless thing he happens upon, and nothing that harms him.
I have to say, this is a passage that quite often comes to mind for me, again and yet again. Work on whatever estranges you from meditation. And I suppose we could be thinking, there could be lots of things. It could be how we're living our lives. It could be the hindrances in meditation. What I did was I went to the seminar that Bhante gave, and I just found a really helpful passage there. So I'll just read a bit of this seminar on this teaching. So somebody's asking Bhante, when they're talking about whatever estranges you from meditation, somebody says to them, is it the fetters, the hindrances that Padmasambhava is talking about here? And Sangharakshita says, well, it could refer to these, but it's interesting that this comes after some experience, apparently, of shunyata, of that tranquility. But clearly it's not a complete experience. So you've had some glimpse or insight, some experience, even of shunyata, but the tendency is to become estranged from that. And this is something we find often happens. You do have a higher, better, even a sort of peak experience in your meditation, whether in the context of a retreat or back at home, or whether you're working. But the tendency is to become estranged from that. It doesn't last. It doesn't persist. And in a strange sort of a way, even though you've got the opportunity of continuing with it, you don't take advantage of that opportunity. There's a strange side to the mind which almost wants to be distracted. We know that one. Well, I know that one. Even though it's in a sense enjoying this higher experience. It's not as though Mara comes along, you know, Mara who came along when the Buddha was on the verge of gaining insight and tempted him with wonderful dancing girls and all sorts of distractions. So he says it's not as though Mara comes along with a big powerful temptation offering you three beautiful women or a whole kingdom. No, it's some silly little thing like a fly buzzing on the wall. Something like that that you will direct your whole attention to rather than the experience of shunyata even. So in this way, we become estranged from your experience. And this is because of the very deeply seated, almost primordial tendencies in ourselves. And it's these that have to be worked upon. And he likens this to the Eightfold Path of Vision and Transformation. So again and yet again, work on whatever estranges you from meditation. Not so much meditation in the narrow sense, but meditation as the means, the precondition for this higher experience. Don't waste it. Don't let it go to waste. Don't throw it away. Preserve it. Cherish it. And set up the conditions that will allow it to continue. Don't allow yourself to be estranged from it. So that's Sangharakshita's his teaching on the teaching. So again and again, work from whatever estranges you from meditation. Lay bare whatever thoughts arise, whatever arises. Lay bare good thoughts, lay bare bad thoughts. So we're not leaving anything out. It's going back to this thing about being completely wholehearted in our practice. We're not leaving anything out. We're not sitting there in meditation when suddenly we experience, perhaps in the fourth stage of the metta bhavana, huge anger. We're not leaving that out. It's there. We take it with us. We have to bring attention to that. We have to bring attention to that. We have to bring attention to these energies that we might not want to recognise in ourselves. We have to bring attention to them because they can be transformed. This is the thing about the Vajrayana. This is the thing about Padmasambhava. There is nothing about us that can't be transformed. I just find that. Thank goodness. You know, thank goodness. So we need to face our demons. They're not just in Tibet. They're here. Our demons are here. Well, my demons are here. You know, they're in amongst here. And if I leave them behind, well, what energy am I leaving behind? Because if you think about the energy that's tied up in, say, a feeling of anger or jealousy or whatever, my goodness, you know, if I could harness that energy, if I could transform that energy, it could take me all the way to enlightenment. You know, so don't leave it behind. Bring it with us. And I've got a little thing here called a purva. just a little paper. And this I also have in my shrine because this helps us to do what Padmasambhava did, which is pin down our demons. Pin them down. Look them in the eye. Look them in the eye. They're okay. And then they shrivel up. They turn into mice sometimes. Purpa, but sometimes I need this one. And I brought this home from a retreat in Dhanakosha, but it's going to stay here in the Buddhist centre. So yes, don't be afraid. And I can say that because quite often I experience great fear in my spiritual life and in my life in general. But Padmasambhava is saying after this that the child who knows his way carries along in the path every harmless thing he happens upon and nothing that harms him. I think, what a child, you know, I work with children, you know, skipping along kind of unaware and picking up this and picking up that and all the rest of it. And I think, I don't understand quite what Padmasambhava is getting at there. But he says the child who knows its way. So, you know, there's this, there's a wisdom there, isn't there? There's a wisdom too. So it's not just about picking up things that you find in the path, things that that bubble up in meditation and taking them all along, whatever. There's a wisdom there about, just being aware of what that is. And I think that the child, and I don't know if I'm right here, but what the image of the child speaks to me about is about your intuition, your own intuition, your own intuitive thoughts that arise. Don't ignore them, because we're not good at, you know, children are very, very intuitive, and somehow as we grow older we lose that ability, well, most of us lose that ability to listen to our inner voice, to listen to our intuition. So I think Padmasambhava is getting at that in this part of the teaching, that you know, listen to our intuition. That'll help us out. Help us out. So could you read the next bit, during the time of insight? Down to no means exists.
During the time of insight, which is surrounded by a time, and gentle aura, openness and appearance are inseparable. The six senses come forth, though appearance and baldness are inseparable. This is the real foundation, without which no means exists.
So during the time of insight, which is surrounded by a calm and gentle aura. I think that speaks for itself. Openness and appearance are inseparable. When I read this, I'm reminded of the Heart Sutra, which Prasada is going to be talking about next week. So I'll just remind you a wee bit about what that says in the Puja. Are people familiar with the Heart Sutra in the Puja? So what this says is, here then, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself, are the same as this. So this is what Padmasambhava is telling us. What he's saying is that, I think, during the time of insight, we have a realisation of non-duality. We have a realisation that there's no separation between form and emptiness. Now, that doesn't mean to say that when we're having this experience that we disappear and up onto a cloud somewhere and we're not there. What I think this means is that you actually realise a state of full, pure experience. And I'm just going to read again a wee bit about what Bhante says about this. So, Antilai consists a bit to Zen teachings, and he says, when the Zen master says, how wonderful, how miraculous, I draw water and I carry fuel, it's not that some sort of strange shunyata type experience has replaced ordinary experience, but that the ordinary experience itself is pervaded and permeated by that higher experience. So it's not as though you're up the hedge, you're away in the clouds somewhere, and that your body suddenly disappears into a void. Your senses are there. And Padmasambhava tells us this. He says, your six senses come forth, though appearance and voidness are inseparable. So I think that what Padmasambhava is saying there is that our way of experiencing the world, when this happens, our way of experiencing the world and of experiencing ourselves would be completely transformed. It would be informed, if you like, by that experience of shunyata, by that experience of the void. And remember, we're not talking about a big empty hole. We're talking about a vibrant, tranquil state of mind filled with potential. And he's saying this is the real foundation. So this is the real foundation when insight will arise.
During the period of meditation, there is not anything, it is simply open. But when you waver towards appearances, delusions will arise. After careful examination, understand not to discriminate, to neither accept nor reject. As anything can happen, peace will arise from within.
Okay, so even at this stage, even at the stage of insight, when insight is arising, even at this stage, even if we've progressed to this stage, even now we can trip ourselves up. Our egos can assert themselves, and it's as if, having reached this stage, that these enemies, these energies, these demons that are hostile to spiritual progress come up going, woof, ha-ha! No, you're not going any further. You're not going any further. And what Padmasambhava is saying to us, but it's simply open. Don't waver towards these appearances. You get that feeling of wavering, you know. Ooh, something interesting's coming up. I'll just go with this. And he's saying, no, don't do that. You know, an idea pops up, an itch develops, we smell the dinner cooking in the next room, and off we go. We go into the story, we talk to ourselves about it, we wonder what's happening. And Padmasambhava is telling us, well, okay, this will happen, because that's what happens when you're making spiritual progress. The parts of you that don't want to will assert themselves, they'll come up, they'll give you trouble, those demons. They'll give you trouble. Padmasambhava is saying, but don't get into a debate about it. You know, don't get into a debate about it. Yes, notice it. Pay it a little attention. And then, let it be. Let it be. Not easy, but let it be. And if we can do this, then we will have an even deeper experience. An even deeper experience of this tranquility of shunyata that he mentions earlier. An even deeper experience of this foundation, the real foundation from which insight arises. Would you like to read the next bit? It's down to unceasingly do dharma actions.
Even when you do not meditate, for personal growth you need to exercise effort. If you do so without accomplishing anything thereby, know that at all times realization is your own nature, and from within act for the benefit of all beings. Unceasingly do dharma actions.
Thank you. So now Padmasambhava is moving from meditation into into our lives, because spiritual practice, spiritual progress doesn't just happen on the cushions. You know, our spiritual lives are not just about what happens when we sit in our cushions. It's about how we go out into the world, what we do out there, the effect that we have on ourselves and the effect that we have on others. So spiritual practice continues when we get up off our cushions. And remember, Queen Yan Chung has not renounced the world. She's out there living in the world. I should think it's a pretty difficult job being a glorious noble queen. So she's out there in the world practicing. And what Padmasambhava is saying, you know, even when you don't meditate, Queen Yan Chung, for personal growth, you have to exercise effort. So don't let your effort dwindle when you're off the cushions. You know, we have to practice out there. We have to do that. Our life is our practice, and we need to keep up the effort. So how do we do that? How do we do that? Well, I think we need to find our own ways of doing that. I think we all have our own ways of doing that. I think spiritual friends, I think our friends can be very helpful, and they can be, you know, they can inspire us and encourage us when things are not going so well. So I think we need to have a bit of help to be more wholehearted in our practice and to be able to take it out into the world. And we need to practice the precepts. We need to remember the ethical dimension of going for refuge. We have to practice the precepts unceasingly. Unceasingly, Padmasambhava says, do dharma actions. Not when you feel like it, or on a Sunday, or on a Thursday night when you go to the Buddhist centre, but unceasingly do dharma actions. And he goes on to say, there's another line, there's another line there. When you purify yourself of your faults, realisation will naturally come from within. And he's talking there about acting for the benefit of all beings. So, unceasingly do dharma actions. Walk the talk, right? Try and walk the talk. Try and keep up the effort. And it's not just for our own benefit. This is for the benefit of all sentient beings. So he's bringing in here the sort of altruistic dimension of going for refuge. He's bringing in here the Bodhisattva ideal. The Bodhisattva ideal being the Bodhisattva who stays in the world until all sentient beings have reached enlightenment. So Padmasambhava is telling us that our practice is for the benefit of all beings. Unceasingly do dharma actions. So practicing the dharma will bring all beings to enlightenment. So I'm just going to read the last... Oh no, I'm not. I'm going to ask Yoni to read just the next two wee lines about seal your virtuous actions.
Seal your virtuous action with prayers and a dedication for the purpose of all beings. Without such prayers and dedication, no means exists.
Yeah. So, prayers and dedications for the benefit of all beings, the purpose of all beings. This reminds me of the transference of merit section at the end of the puja, when we've accumulated all this merit. So you imagine Queen Yan Chung, she's accumulating all this merit by practicing, by meditating, reaching quite refined meditative states, perhaps having experiences of insight, practicing the precepts, and she's accumulated all this merit, and she will just give it away for the benefit of all beings. So that's what that bit reminds me of. It reminds me of the transference of merit and self-surrender. And Padmasambhava is reminding us that actually, because he says, Without such prayers and dedications, no means exists. So he's reminding us that actually we need to do this for our spiritual progress and for the progress of all beings. That's why we're doing it. Okay. Do you want to read the very last bit?
Not falling into the errors of excitement or passivity, be filled with confidence. Here in a few words of great import, by preparation, enactment and fulfilment, the doctrine's deepest reaches of this life, as of the life to come. Thus did he speak, and Queen Nanjing was led to salvation.
Thank you. So, not falling into the errors of excitement or passivity. Aha. Well, I certainly do that. I'm sure we all do that. I'm sure we all experience that. You know, this imbalance of our energies, this imbalance between excitement and passivity. Well, it's human. It's part of our human nature. It's our way. But what Padmasambhava is saying is that we've not, you know, we've not to tip over into these. You know, we need to find the balance. And again, we need to find a sort of middle way through them. And it's those energies again, isn't it? It's those energies. So important in the Vajrayana, so important in this tradition. We can still experience excitement and passivity, but don't fall into them. Don't indulge them. Find a way to transform them. And it's this thing about finding a way to transform our demons, to bring all of us, bring all those energies together onto the path. And Padmasambhava tells us very clearly that when we're able to do that, we'll be filled with confidence, filled with faith, shraddha. We will have confidence in our practice. Here he says, in a few words of great import, which is what Queen Nanjing asked for, words of great import that she could memorise and take with her to practice. So Padmasambhava is saying, well, here, in a few words of great import, lie preparation. Remember, don't waste time. Pay urgent attention to impermanence. Strongly turn your mind to going for refuge and direct your prayers to the lamas. Preparation. Enactment. Our meditation practice. Our ethical practice. So there's a bit of the threefold path coming in here. The sila, ethics, samadhi, meditation, and pranya, wisdom. And fulfilment. The fulfilment of reaching enlightenment, of realising enlightenment, of realisation for the benefit of all beings. And it's all there. All there. A complete teaching. Thoroughly recommend it to you. And Queen Nanjing was led to salvation. Sadhu!